head guy in the cabal, changed his vote. Suddenly the court was voting with Franklin Roosevelt, and that was the end of that. FDR said, okay, you know, we don't need to pack the court. But I think that time may come again.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth, celebrating the International Day of Democracy. We've taken a look back at local democratic efforts of the past year through the pandemic. All of our past episodes are available online at kboo.fm/newsindepth. And if you like content like this, produced by volunteers for the community, consider supporting us with a donation. Check out kboo.fm/IDD for the International Day of Democracy to learn more. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Sprouts tackling electoral integrity in the United States.
This is KBOO Portland.
Whoa, 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 whoa. You say you look up all the time. Hey, I'm a working girl. You're just a wasted man.
On the upcoming edition of Moving On, Don Jacobson will be featuring the music of Nancy Griffith. Blending folk and country, she created a genre of music that was her own. We will hear from Nancy and other artists who pay tribute to her music with their own versions of Nancy's music. Tune in this Friday, a few minutes after noon, only on KBOO.
Just once, any very blue moon, and that be one coming on soon. Just once in a very blue moon.
Community radio is a democratic type of media, but what does that mean? This fall drive, KBOO is examining what democracy means to each of us by featuring content focusing on picking apart democracy. To support our programs during this fall drive, go to kboo.fm. and get the limited edition Sounds of Democracy shirt.
Welcome to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location each week.
It's almost like somebody had a plan.
I'm Spencer Graves with 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Today on Sprouts, we will discuss election integrity, voter fraud, voter suppression, and gerrymandering. In 1980, Republican Christian conservative Paul Weyrich said, quote, "I don't want everybody to vote. Our leverage in the elections goes up as the voting populace goes down." In 1981, the Republican National Committee was found guilty of voter caging, a form of voter suppression. Republicans have lost several similar cases since then. Our first guest, Mac Heller, founded the American Issues Initiative and produced the movie Rigged, the Voter Suppression Playbook. We then hear from David Armiak, research director with the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, who discusses the voter suppression activities of the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. We follow this by interviewing Lauren Bonds, legal director of the Kansas ACLU, and Denise Lieberman, general counsel of the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition, who are leading the fight against voter suppression in Kansas and Missouri. Mac?
I was surprised in 2013 when the Supreme Court, in a case called Shelby County versus Holder, gutted a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, and even more surprised to read the opinion and find that the basis of the Supreme Court's invalidation of that provision of the Voting Rights Act was the premise that the era of racial discrimination in voting in the United States was over. In the years since 2013, Shelby County versus Holder has opened the door for a torrent of voter suppression legislation in the American South, but not only in the American South. I was very struck by the provision of new laws regulating voting, solving problems that no one thought we had, preventing a number of Americans from voting. I was also concerned about the allegations of widespread voter fraud. I'm against fraud. I'm sure you're against fraud. Everybody's against fraud. I started the American Issues Initiative to explore this issue and to undertake an inquiry as to whether there was widespread voter fraud, as to whether there was significant voter suppression, as to whether there was any link between the two. We also came to know the people on the other side of this debate, the people who are sure that there is widespread voter fraud and steps must be taken to combat it. And so in the film, we are embedded with the Voter Integrity Project of North Carolina and spend substantial time with them. They didn't find any voter fraud, but they, at the end of election day, give us their view that their failure to find any fraud just proves how widespread and devious it really is. At that, I throw up my hands. If you want to suppress the vote, you should consider activity in any or all of the following five areas. Number one, make it difficult to register to vote. Number two, make it difficult to stay registered by purging names from the voting rolls. Number three, if you fail to purge the names, make it difficult for people to vote. Number four, make it unlikely that that vote would be counted after it's been cast. Make it difficult for that vote to be counted. And number five, if the vote is cast and counted, make the vote not matter. And the technique there is gerrymandering. When we talk about making it difficult for certain types of people to register, there are the things like closing registration locations in areas where you don't want people to register, reducing the days and hours. North Carolina has ended same-day registration. Don't allow registration online. Don't allow pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds. Some states had had a program where kids in high school would be offered the opportunity to register the vote at age 16 or 17 in a government class or history or a civics class. Most civics classes have been terminated for reasons we can only wonder about. When the kid turns 18, they're ready to vote. The number of 18-year-olds in this country who have a driver's license is about 61%. So if you have a voter ID requirement that wants a driver's license, you're going to keep a lot of 18-year-olds from voting. Kansas passed a law requiring documentary proof of citizenship. That's usually a birth certificate, but it might also be a naturalization document. Some of us in America were not given a birth certificate, perhaps because they are African Americans not born in a hospital. If you're female and the name on your driver's license today is Jane Smith, but you were born as Janie Jones and then you married Bill White and divorced him and then married Joe Jones, to register to vote in Kansas under this law, you would need to provide your birth certificate, your marriage decree from your first marriage, your divorce decree, and then your marriage certificate from your second marriage. The studies show that if people go through the effort to register and are denied the opportunity, or if they do register and are purged from the rolls, the likelihood they will re-register is low. And the perpetrators of these laws know that. It's a strategy to prevent people from voting. I'm going to move on to prohibitions or burdens on the canvassing process. This is new laws in Texas, Ohio. There was one proposed in Tennessee. These are quite material. They're presented as benign administrative matters, but their intent and effect is to limit registration drives. Registration drives are most effective in recruiting future voters who are young and poorer. So what do? Well, you require significant training for canvassers and then give the training only once a month. And then you allow the canvasser to operate only in the county in which he or she was trained. To cap it off, you do the following. If some brave registration group manages to register hundreds or even thousands of voters and submits those registration forms to the State Board of Elections, the Secretary of State alleged that there are mistakes in 10 of 10,000 applications. These may be mistakes, but you call them fraud. If Spencer misspells his name or his handwriting is not clear, Spencer may think that's a mistake, but the Secretary of State calls it fraud. and announces a big investigation and impounds as evidence the thousands of registration applications that have been submitted. Those people are not registered. You put together those three things, and there are probably others. It's almost like somebody had a plan. Number two, if somebody manages to register, purge their name from the voter rolls. There are many, many ways to do this, but the predominant one is to purge people who have not voted in two federal election cycles. In Ohio, Secretary of State had a list of 240,000 names to be cut. On the basis that they've died or left the county, League of Women Voters said, why don't you give us the list and we'll see whether any of these people should remain properly registered voters. And out of the 240,000 names, about 35,000, between 15 and 20%, were still alive, still living in the county, and upset that their right to vote would be taken away. The state of Georgia has purged 1.5 million names over the last few years. The process to decide to purge these names was minimal. It was originally set forth in a 1903 Jim Crow law designed, per the press of the times, to purge the few remaining African Americans from the voting rolls. And this is shocking to me. If you are on the Board of Elections, your job is to help eligible citizens vote, not to profligately cut them from the voter rolls. I was outraged by that purge proceeding. It's taking place in many states around our country. Many of these are swing states, like North Carolina, like Georgia, like Ohio. Number three, if someone does manage to remain registered to vote, make it difficult for them to vote. This is reduce the number of polling locations, locate them away from poor neighborhoods, reduce the number of machines. If you change the polling location, don't give notice. Don't have early voting. Don't have polling places on college campuses. Reduce the hours. And the current favorite, require government-issued photo ID to vote. This is not a new issue in election administration. People have been asking that question and getting the answer for decades. And the way that traditionally one gave the answer was by presenting an ID, including government-issued photo IDs, but government-issue non-photo IDs, like a VA card or a Social Security card, presenting a bank statement or a utility bill or all three. And if someone is out to execute widespread voter fraud, it's really unlikely that they're going to find bank statements, utility bills, and non-government issued photo ID from enough voters to swing an election. I've looked and I've never seen an instance of that. This voter ID thing is much more about keeping some people from voting. It's solving an integrity problem that didn't exist. In North Carolina in 2016, out of almost 5 million votes, there was one case, a woman who voted for her mother at her mother's instructions. The mother had just passed away. About 10% of people in this country don't have a driver's license. That number is higher for people who are poor. It's higher for people who are old. It's higher for people who are very young, and it's higher for people who are of color. And the designers of these laws know that. In Texas, the registered voters who didn't have the right ID, 600,000. In Wisconsin, 300,000. In North Carolina, 400,000. In North Carolina, the legislature asked which IDs people had. They asked, how do people vote? And it turns out that people of color don't have certain IDs, and they tend to vote early, frequently on Sunday. That's what the legislature cut. In Texas, the legislature had a list of IDs and who holds them. Government employee IDs, University of Texas IDs, differentially held by people of color in Texas, which is a majority-minority state. Concealed carry licenses held 86% by white people. Concealed carry licenses qualify, but government IDs, government employee IDs, University of Texas IDs don't. Vote by mail, very important in this election. Burden that application with a requirement that it be notarized or witnessed. Notarization costs a few bucks. Is that a poll tax? I think so. There is a signature match requirement. Notarization and witnesses in a time of COVID, not a good idea. Send those people an absentee ballot. Make it postage prepaid. If you want to cut younger voters out of a process, require them to buy a stamp. The fail rate on absentee ballots is substantially higher than on in-person ballots. The fail rate on absentee ballots nationwide is about 1%. For voters of color, it's been about 2%. Number four, if they vote, don't count the ballot, that can be absentee ballot signature matches, but can also be people voting out of precinct. If you have always voted at the elementary school down the street and you get there and somebody tells you that you've been changed to some other place and you say, can I please cast a ballot here? And they let you, those ballots are thrown away in many states. Finally, five, if someone succeeds in registering, succeeds in staying registered, succeeds in voting and succeeds in having the vote counted, make it not matter. It means gerrymandering. Those are the five buckets. Make it difficult to register to vote, make it difficult to stay registered by purging people off the rolls, make it difficult to vote, try not to count the vote, and then if the vote counts, make it not matter through gerrymandering. I actually believe that if every eligible citizen were allowed to vote, our decisions in our country would be better. I don't think any one person or any one group has all the answers.
Matt Keller said that it's almost like somebody had a plan. In fact, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, has drafted model legislation on voter suppression, versions of which have been passed by several states, according to the Center for Media and Democracy, or CMD. David Armiak is the CMD's research director. David, can you comment?
In 2009, ALEC had a task force called the Public Safety and Elections Task Force. That was responsible in 2009 for passing a model bill on voter ID. It serves to disenfranchise mainly low-income, minority, elderly, and student voters who do not have driver's license, or many of them don't have driver's license. You know, some do, but many don't. The model bill provides for free IDs. In many states, these offices are not easy to get to. In some states, they purposely move these offices away from public transportation, which is often used by these groups that don't have tons of money. Wisconsin's bill went even further. This was, we believe, based off of the ALEC one. It required that the driver's license or identification card used has a permanent current address. Even if the ID isn't expired, if your address isn't current on the ID, you can't use that to vote. It makes it really difficult for students. Students are moving around, and also low-income individuals who are often renting. These bills are purposely designed to disenfranchise and are probably the most well-known example of ALEC's effort.
We have been listening to Mac Haller, producer of the movie Rig, the Voter Suppression Playbook, and David Armiak with the Center for Media and Democracy describing how claims of voter fraud have been used to justify voter suppression. The comparison between voter fraud and voter suppression is illustrated in Judge Julie Robinson's findings of fact and conclusions of law in Fish versus Kobach. She noted that over 31,000 voter registration applications had been rejected to save Kansas from the threat posed by 39 non-citizens who registered to vote there. 31,000 citizens disenfranchised versus 39 non-citizen registrants, almost 1,000 to 1. We next hear from Denise Lieberman, General Counsel for the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition.
Unfortunately, voters and their advocates have had to take to the courts for the better part of a decade to combat the virulent assault on the right to vote that we've seen across this country since 2010. These are compounded by the current pandemic. The Missouri legislature passed a new law that at least acknowledges the barriers that the current pandemic poses to voters and their safety. No voter should have to risk their safety and their health to vote. This new law in Missouri does provide some expanded options for Missourians to vote absentee. They're exceedingly confusing, difficult to follow. The measures that were passed still place a great deal of barriers, including a notary requirement, and requires voters to only send and receive these ballots over the mail. Our lawsuit is currently pending in court. We've argued that anybody who is quarantining, confining themselves because of COVID, should be able to cast an absentee ballot without a notary already under Missouri law. In addition, we argue that people who are casting ballots by mail, which require a notary seal, should not have to risk their safety in order to procure that notary seal.
There's also one, isn't there, about gerrymandering?
Absolutely. There's a myriad of voting issues here in Missouri, and there have been for quite a long time. And one of them is the so-called Dirty Missouri Amendment 3, which will be on the ballot in November. And it's an attempt to roll back reforms that voters passed overwhelmingly in 2018, literally by two-thirds to one-third in every jurisdiction in the state of Missouri, to impose fairer processes for creating those district maps.
Great. Lauren, the situation on those issues now in Kansas are not as severe as in Missouri, given the status of Fish versus Kobach. Am I right?
We have a different set of problems. They are not quite as extreme at the moment. Unlike in Missouri, Kansas does have a robust absentee ballot and vote by mail system. One of the problems that we have here in Kansas is just making sure that people are actually getting their ballots. One of our biggest issues here is just we don't have an effective system to deal with the new influx of vote-by-mail applications that we're getting in light of the pandemic. We've gotten dozens of reports from the primary election of people who requested ballots and just never got them. And unfortunately, we're seeing that there's not a lot of records at either the county election official office or the Secretary of State's office of these ballots ever being requested, even though we have paper trails and receipts from the voter who made the request. People not being able to register before our pretty far out registration deadline. Photo ID requirements that are too restrictive for people to be able to verify their identity at the polls and cast their ballot. And we have poll workers who are refusing to wear PPE. We have voters who are refusing to wear PPE.
Wonderful. Denise, tell us more about the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition.
The Missouri Voter Protection Coalition is a nonpartisan statewide network that works to protect the right to vote. We've been convening as a statewide nonpartisan table since 2006, and we effectuate our work through policy advocacy, engaging in legal advocacy and litigation, like the lawsuit we currently have, challenging provisions of Missouri's absentee and mail-in voting laws, engaging in public education. And of course, our signature effort, our election protection effort. And this is really important for all of your listeners to know, is that this is a nonpartisan national hotline. It's live. Anyone across the country can call 866-OUR-VOTE, 866-687-8683, and be connected immediately with an attorney who can address the voting situation that you may be confronting, answer some questions wherever you're calling from about the rules in your state, and help you navigate the voting process. It's also really important to help document issues that are going on.
Wonderful. Lauren, what do you suggest for people who want to support your efforts?
If you are interested in helping the ACLU protect voting rights, there are so many ways that you can help. The ACLU of Kansas, we have a pretty robust legislative advocacy program that depends on actual residents of Kansas, people who live here, being able to go to their elected official and say, we need election day registration. We need a way to fix all of our provisional ballots.
Wonderful. Denise, how did you get motivated to pursue this kind of work?
That's a great question. Both my parents were elected officials, and I have memories of very, very young going door to door in our neighborhood, which had been blockbusted, to help get residents support for this as a very young child. So I feel like this has always been in my blood. I used to work at the ACLU before honing in on voting rights full time, because it's really at the core of what gives us our voice. It's what gives us power. It is what gives people self-determination. It confers dignity. It is a basic tool that we have as a society to say that you matter, that you count, literally, you count. And collectively, it is a tool to build power that is necessary to enact social change.
Wonderful. Lauren, how did you get into this?
I'm the first person in my dad's family who was born with all of their rights in this country. After the Voting Rights Act was passed, after all the civil rights legislation was passed and really perfected our Constitution in so many ways. And so I've always kind of felt an obligation and a responsibility to make sure that those rights don't get taken away. And we see them being chipped at every Supreme Court session, every legislative session. And I just feel like this work is something that's so important for all of us to do who are so lucky to be born with all of our rights.
Great.
Talk to me about the League of Women Voters. Denise?
Sure. The League of Women Voters is a really prominent leader in the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition. They provide critical educational information to people through their Vote 411 website that allows people to be informed voters. And when voters are informed, they participate.
Wonderful. Lauren, Chris Kobach, in a press conference a few years back, said that he was very concerned with two communist organizations, the League of Women Voters and the American Civil Liberties Union. You want to comment?
Sure. The League of Women Voters has also been a plaintiff in a number of our cases, but in particular, our documentary Proof of Citizenship Challenge, Bishby Kobach. They play such a critical role in registering people to vote. They are nonpartisan, as far as I am aware. They have no communist affiliations, as far as I'm aware. Facts don't particularly matter for some of our elected officials.
Just to refresh, you said if you see a problem,
I certainly will encourage anybody to call 866-OUR-VOTE. There's also language access hotlines. There is a hotline that is answered entirely in Spanish. 888-D-VOTA is answered in Spanish. It is the Spanish Election Protection Hotline. There's also a hotline answered in 6 different Asian languages, as well as an Arabic language hotline as well, to ensure that all people have access to the resources and support they need. Knowledge is power, and oftentimes we find that when people are armed with information about their rights, they're able to effectively assert and advocate their rights. Mm-hmm. Here in Missouri as well, there will be the so-called Dirty Missouri, the Amendment 3, the rollback to the Clean Missouri Amendments, that could have a real profound effect on reversing some really critical reforms that were passed overwhelmingly by 2/3 of Missouri voters in 2018 that provide for really important redistricting reform, ethics reforms, ensure that all people are fairly counted for purposes of redistricting, stop the partisan gerrymandering.
I read Judge Julie Robinson's findings of fact and conclusions of law. This expert witness, Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation, said that something like 3% of people called for jury duty in a certain federal jurisdiction were non-citizens, and he extrapolated that to the entire U.S. population. On cross-examination, the ACLU attorneys noted that he cited only the upper bound of 1 of 8 federal jurisdictions for which there were data, and the other 7 had a maximum of 1%, and 4 of them had 0. Judge Robinson overturned the documentary proof of citizenship requirement, and the appellate court upheld it.
This case was first decided by our district court, as you mentioned, by Judge Julie Robinson back in June of 2018. There was an order in
Robinson appointed by President George W. Bush, a Republican.
She's not a communist, as far as I know either. Judge Robinson issued this injunction back in June of 2018. In the injunction, she prohibited the requirement of documentary proof of citizenship. The Secretary of State's office decided to appeal the decision. The 10th Circuit agreed with Judge Robinson, upheld the decision in its entirety, and we had another opportunity for the Secretary of State to decide whether he wanted to continue to potentially waste taxpayer money. He decided that he wanted to do that. That is where the case is now. It is called a petition for cert to the Supreme Court.
If Missouri voters reject Amendment 3, it could end gerrymandering in Missouri, leaving intact the 2018 Clean Missouri Constitutional Amendment. Republican Representative Hannah Kelly predicted that if that happens, it will be devastating to Republicans, who currently hold over 70% of the seats in the Missouri House of Representatives, the Missouri Senate, and the Missouri delegation in the U.S. House of Representatives. With only 47% of Missourians saying they are Republican or leaning Republican, it is difficult to imagine how they can get such strong majorities without gerrymandering. Since that interview with Denise Lieberman, a judge ruled that the ballot language for Amendment 3, written by the legislature, was unconstitutionally misleading. Missouri Republicans appealed. The appellate judge mandated a ballot summary different from what the legislature and the circuit court had written. Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt, a Republican, said he planned to appeal, but later decided not to. That's it for Sprouts. This broadcast was excerpted from longer interviews with Matt Keller, producer of the movie Rigged, the Voter Suppression Playbook, David Armiak, Research Director at the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, Denise Lieberman, General Counsel for the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition, and Lauren Bonds, Legal Director of the ACLU of Kansas.
These interviews are available via a Wikiversity article on electoral integrity in the United States. That's Wikiversity, not Wikipedia. Almost anyone can change almost anything on Wikimedia Foundation projects like Wikipedia or this Wikiversity article on electoral integrity in the United States.
The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Spencer Grace with KPFI Kansas City Community Radio. Thanks for listening. See you next week on Sprouts.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when people who use drugs are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. Nil de nobis sine nobis. Nothing about us without us. A simple concept. It's fundamental to representative